This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We're told that Mikne Rav Hoyo Livnei Reuven Velivnei God Otsum Oid. There was great quantities of cattle belonging to Bnei Reuven and the Bnei God, enormous amounts. By Yirus Eretz Yazev, why did they have to draw near to him? They were already in the middle of a conversation. Why did you have to draw near? You're near him. Says the Akedah, they must have gone away and come back. Why did they go away? To discuss, to have a conference, to decide how they would respond to Moshe's anger. Which means it wasn't at all so poshut. Otherwise they would have said straight away, they would have stopped him in the middle of the sentence. Moshe Rabbeinu, Chas V'Sholem, do you think that's what we mean? After Moshe got angry, 1 minute Moshe can't come back and we finish by Yikshu, then they came back and they say, oh, we'll build our kraals and cities over here and we will lead the battle into Eretz Yisrael. The interesting thing is that in the Medrash, that's not what they're criticized for at all. There's a lot of censure of Bnei Reuven and Bnei Gad in Chazal, but no mention of the fact that they intended not to fight the battle. The censure is the fact that they wanted to live there altogether, that they were prepared to live in that area, in Eber HaYarden, on the other side of the Jordan, and that they didn't want to go into Eretz Yisrael, and that they did it because of their cattle. And we need to look at a few Medroshim. Unfortunately, because we have to look at a few Medroshim, we're not going to have the time to analyze them thoroughly, but merely to analyze one point in these Medroshim. But let's get a bit of a bird's eye view of the Medroshim concerned, and then we'll hone in on the particular point that needs analysis. Says the Medrash, Gimel Matonus Livrulu Ba'ilam. Three gifts were given to the, were created in the world. Zocho Ba'achas Mehen. If a person is fortunate enough to have one of these three gifts, Notal Chemdas Kol Ho'ilom, he is able to take all the desired precious things of the whole world. There's no limit to what he can achieve if he has one of these three. Zocho b'chokhma, zocho b'chol. A person who has wisdom has it all. Zocho b'gvuro, zocho b'kul. One who has power has got it all. Zocho b'isher, zocho b'chol. Somebody who has wealth has got it all. If you have wisdom, you know how to manipulate. If you have power, you know how to force. And if you have money, you know how to buy. And with any of those three, you can get whatever you want. You don't need them all. One is enough. A Messiah, one provision. When does this apply? Bizman Shehein Matnoi Shomai. When these are given by the Ribbono Shel Olam. Uvois Bekeach HaTorah. And they come through the power of the Torah. Two conditions. That come from the Ribbono Shel Olam through the Torah. But the power and wealth of a human being, that's not worth anything at all. The Medrash brings Psukim to prove that, to illustrate that point. And goes on to say, Shonu Rabbi Seinu, Shnei Chachomim Omdu Ba'ilu. Our rabbis learned, two Chachomim existed in the world, Echod Mi Yisrael Ve'echod Mi Yivdei Chachomim, one Jew and one Gentile. Achitofel mi Yisrael uvilom meumus ha'ilom. Achitofel was the Jew and Bilom was the Goy. Ushneim nevdu min ha'ilom. They both got destroyed. Their wisdom didn't help them. So you see that wisdom isn't always a guarantee to being a solution to all problems. Likewise, there were two powerful men who existed in the world. Echod mi Yisrael ve'echod meumus ha'ilom. One Jew, one Gentile. Shimshon mi Yisrael, the Goliath mi Yisraelim. Shimshon the Jew and Goliath the Goy. Shneim nevdu min ha'ilom, and both of them were destroyed. V'chein shnei ashirim omdu ba'ilom, and likewise two wealthy people existed in the world. Echod mi Yisrael, ve'echod mi Yisraelim. One Jew and one Gentile. Korach mi Yisrael, ve'homan mi Yisraelim. Korach the Jew and Homan the Goy. Shneim nevdu min ha'ilom, both were destroyed. in each of these cases, their respective wisdom, power, and wealth was not able to save them. So you see, it's not always. It's by no means in all circumstances that this can affect a solution to one's problems. Lama, why? Not because one's a Jew, one's a goy. You see, that's not important. Who the person is not what's important. What is important is sheloi hoyo matnoson min HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Their gifts did not come from the Ribbono Shel Olam, ela chotfin ois Elohim, they grabbed it for themselves. Medrash goes on. V'chein atom eitze b'nei Gadim b'nei Reuven. You find the same with b'nei Gadim b'nei Reuven. Shehayu ashirim, they were wealthy. V'hoyo lohim miknei Gadol, and they had a great quantity of cattle. V'chovavu es mamonam, and they loved their money. V'yoshvu lohim chutz me'eretz Yisrael. And they were prepared to live outside of the borders of Eretz Yisrael. And the truth is that even the area where they lived had Kedushas Eretz Yisrael, because it was conquered by the Al-Pi Adibur, it was conquered by instruction of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and there was Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael there too. It wasn't as if they were living in Chutz La'aretz altogether, but we'll deal with that a little later. That's what they are criticized for, that their desire for money was sufficient to motivate them to a willingness to live outside the borders of Eretz Israel, goof of the strict, limited borders of Eretz Israel. Lefichach golu tchilo mikol hashvuti. The consequence of that was that they were the first to be to go into golus, to go into exile of all the tribes. They went first. That's the first medrash. Another medrash. Not by virtue of a man toiling and working in business and travelling from east to west does he become wealthy. Even if he goes out in ships and he goes from east to west, and he travels in the deserts, the Alehorim and the mountains, in an Ase Oshi. That's not going to make him wealthy. She'ein odom misroime min advorim ho'ilu, a person doesn't become great through these things. Ma'akodesh Baruch Hu, what does the Ribbono Shel Olam do? Meitel nechosim mizeh v'noisim l'zeh. Wealth is just a movement. The Ribbono Shel Olam takes money from this one and he gives it to that one. And he takes it from that one and he gives it to that other. It's like musical chairs. It goes around. It's not you who have to move to get the money. You stand still. The money passes you. You have your turn and it comes and it goes and it goes. To that. That's how it goes. Lekach nikro shemam nechosim. That's why it's called nechosim. Nechosim is property, assets. Because they become covered to this one and open to this one all the time. They appear and they disappear. And why are coins called zuzin? They move from this one, they go to that. Money is always moving. Money is not meant to be stored. It goes around. Midrash goes on along the same lines, and further on says, Shola Matruna Achas is Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta. Certain women asked Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta, Lekama yomim bora HaKadosh Baruch Hu es hayolam. How long did it take the Ribbono Shel Olam to create the world? Amalo l'sheshis yomim. He said, 6 days. Shenema ki sheshis yomim osa Hashem es ha-shamayim ve-sa-ot. It took 6 days, as it says in the Pasuk. In 6 days, the Ribbono Shel Olam created heaven and earth. Omra lo, she said to him, Me'isa shor v'ad achshor ma'isa. Imagine today if one went into a god of Israel and went off in such a shayla, how he would react. This is Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta, listen to the question and tell me, from then, since then, what's it, 6 days it took him in the answer to create the world? What's he been doing since then if you can create the whole world in 6 days? What takes so long? What else has he been doing? Omar lo, he said to her, Yoshev Isse Sulomus. He plays snakes and ladders. That's what he does. He makes ladders. He brings this one up and he takes that one down. That's what he does. Teidolochem. I'll give you an illustration. Keshebikesh Yashiru Bnei Reuven Ubnei God, when the Ribbono Shelo wanted Bnei Reuven and Bnei God to become wealthy, he peeled a Midianim lifnei Yisrael. He caused the Midianites to fall before Yisrael. Kedeshi Yashiru Bnei God Ubnei Reuven, so that Bnei God and Bnei Reuven should become wealthy. That's why this parasha stems comes straight after the parasha of Midian. Lekayim Ashenema, to fulfill the pasuk as it says, horim, not from traveling and from the east and from the west, nor from deserts or from mountains or uplifting oneself. Eloki Elokim shofet b'ribono shel olam judges, ze yashpil v'ze yorim. This one he brings down and this one he takes up. It's a pendulum system. You can't have one going up without the other one going down. In Ruchnes we've often talked in spiritual things a person can gain without anybody else losing. But in Gashmius it doesn't work like that. In material things it doesn't work like that. There is a limited amount of material prosperity. And anyone who has it at the expense of somebody else. It must be that way. You can't all have it. The difficulty that I want to deal with briefly this evening is just the one point. That is, in the first Midrash we learned that when is wealth all-powerful, when it's a matona of the Ribbono Shel Olam. But when you grab it yourself, it has no potency at all. But Chayin the Medrash said, and so it was with Bnei God and Bnei Reuven. And the very next Medrash tells us, and how did the Bnei God and Bnei Reuven get wealthy? Keshebikesh HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted to make them wealthy. He caused the Midianites to fall so that they could get the wealth. So what greater matona could there be from the Ribbono Shel Olam than that? This wasn't Bnei God and Bnei Reuven grabbing their own wealth. The Ribbono Shel Olam caused the whole war and caused the fall of an entire nation because he wanted the Bnei God and Bnei Reuven to be wealthy. And that the Medrash calls chotfin, that they're grabbing it themselves. It's interesting that this, my approach to this Medrash is again based on the Tiferet Tzion, who is the great-grandfather of Mrs. Bukov. The great-great-grandfather of Mrs. Bukov is here with us this evening. He says, this is not a question of the Ritzon Hashem or not the Ritzon Hashem. Anybody who gets wealthy through the Ritzon Hashem, nobody becomes wealthy without God's will. That's not what it means when it says, a matona from the Ribbono Shel Olam, a gift of God. That says that the Tiferet Tzion, there are different ways in which cycles of wealth operate. The one is b'derech hateva. One is by natural means. A person becomes wealthy not through any miracle. It all happened naturally. Of course it's hashgacha. Of course the Ribbono Shel Olam organized it. But if you look at it on the surface, it's perfectly natural. He bought Krugerrands and the price went up. And he sold his Krugerrands and he made a lot of money. That's what happened. Is it a miracle? It's not a miracle. Is that called a matona from the Ribbono Shel Olam? No. That's not called a matona from the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's called normal natural means. A matona from the Ribbono Shel Olam is b'derech nes altogether. He's walking along the street and he finds a bucket of Krugerrands. And he asks who it belongs to and nobody knows anything about it. That's a matona from the Ribbono Shel Olam. It's different. We discussed when we talked about the difference between Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz, we discussed pre-programmed nature and nature which is not programmed. And we discussed how in Chutz La'aretz the cycles, the economic cycles and the agricultural cycles and the climatic cycles are all pre-programmed. And there's nothing much we can do to change the programs. The Hashgacha Pratis is that within the programs, each individual, you can still find a yid who the Ribbono Shel Olam makes wealthy even when the gold price falls. But to change the cycles, that can't be done. That's all pre-programmed. In Eretz Yisrael, there's no program. One day doesn't join the cycles of nature don't follow on. If chartists, I don't know if the chartists work in Eretz Yisrael, but according to this, a chartist system of analyzing trends would not work in Eretz Yisrael. It doesn't work on the chart. Each day is decided. What's going to happen today to the economy and to the agriculture of Eretz Israel is dependent on the behavior of the nation the day before. That's all that's important. It has nothing to do with any kind of trends or cycles or anything else. So here there is a concept of a person making money through the natural cycles, and there's a concept of a person making money quite independent of natural cycles. And when it says that the Bnei God, the Chaim Bnei God, the Bnei Reuven, they too grabbed their own wealth, that was because they made their money with the Ritzon Hashem. The Ribbono Shel Olam wanted them to have it, but it wasn't a matzona, it wasn't a gift of the Ribbono Shel Olam in terms of the way we've just defined it. So why did they want to stay in Chutz Lo'etz? Why did they want to stay in Eiver HaYarden? Well, now we understand it very well. They've acquired their wealth by natural means. They surely utilize natural means to preserve their wealth. Eretz Yisrael is not a place which is naturally conducive to cattle farming. And here they've got an opportunity where they come, and it's the most beautiful land, and it's been conquered, it belongs to Klal Yisrael already, and it has most of the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, and it's ideal for the wealth which they have just acquired with the obvious blessing of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Surely they must use natural means in order to preserve it. And therefore, this is the right place for them to dwell, thus enabling them to devote a minimum amount of time to their business affairs. Of course, that was their intention. There's no having that their intention was just to amass more and more wealth. The intention was, we, Baruch Hashem, are wealthy already. It's been a miracle, it's been unbelievable. We have our wealth, all we need to do is preserve it. If we can take this land, which is so good for cattle, we'll have to invest a minimum of time and effort into our businesses, which will leave us available for Avodas Hashem for most of the day and for most of the year. We'll have nothing to worry about. It's 100% Hashem Shemayim. Must have been. And yet that decision was wrong. As a Midrash in Vayikra, Shevet Reuven v'Shevet Gad, the tribe of Reuven and Gad, b'shol she'nichnusu la'oretz, when they came into Eretz Yisrael, v'rol kamo zero yeshbo, kamo neto yeshbo, and they saw what kind of seed and what kind of produce there was in that land. Omru, they said, Toiv moli kaf nachas b'eretz b'oretz hazois v'moli chufnaim b'eivir hayarde. One little handful of nachas is better in this land than a big helping in eivir hayarde. In other words, they suddenly realized they could have existed here too. They thought this land was not hospitable to cattle farming. When they came in, they saw, no, this is better. It would have been better for them to have been here. It's too late. They've been given Eiver HaYarden, and that's the area. The moment they were given Eiver HaYarden, and the rest of Klal Yisrael got larger portions relative in Eretz Yisrael itself, and therefore that it was too late now. They had to stay in Eiver HaYarden. But they realized they'd made a mistake. They should have been in Eretz Yisrael. And we see later on, as the Medrash tells us, Leficha Golut Chilo, they were the first tribe to be exiled. So we see they in fact are punished for making that choice. What is wrong with that choice? How could they have known? They come and they see this ideal land. They know that Eretz Israel is not designed for cattle farming. They see this ideal land. They want to take it. What's so wrong? What did they do wrong? The Medrash says they were prepared to sit in Chutz Lo'aretz. They loved their money, and they were willing to sit outside of Eretz Yisrael. Why is it called Chutz L'Eretz Yisrael? After all, that also is Eretz Yisrael. So there are a few halachas which don't apply there, just a few. Midoraisa, from the laws of the Torah, Bikurim cannot be brought from that part. Bikurim come only from the limited borders of Eretz Yisrael, not from there. The Rabbonim from there also, but not the Doraisa. The Omer and the Shtei Lechem, the loaves of bread that used to be brought, couldn't come from there, the Ram says, in the Dorim. That's not from that part of Eretz Yisrael, only from the limited borders of Eretz Yisrael. So there are a few halachas, there are a few mitzvahs, Hatzluyus Boretz, Trumas and Maisus, and all that applied there as well. There are just a few halachas which applied in the restricted area of Eretz Yisrael and not in the expanded area of Eretz Yisrael. Good. Okay, so an extra few mitzvahs they could have done in Eretz Yisrael, but they've got their cattle to worry about as well. So what really did they do wrong? If we incorporate the Medrash and Vayikra which we just learned, there's only one thing they did wrong. They shouldn't have made their decision before they went into Eretz Yisrael. That's all. They should have said to Moshe Rabbeinu, you know, this land looks good. Let's bear it in mind. We'll go into Eretz Yisrael, and you should know we volunteer that if Eretz Yisrael is not suitable for cattle, and you would like us to settle over here, thus giving the rest of Klal Yisrael more place in Eretz Yisrael itself, we'll be prepared to do it because we feel that's the right place for us to be. We've got to be where it's good for cattle. But they made no suggestion to see Eretz Yisrael first. They decided and committed themselves to what they had without seeing what was on the other side of the Yarden. What caused them to do that? That really is amazing when you think of it. They would have lost nothing by waiting. They would have lost nothing at all by saying to Moshe Rabbeinu, look, we don't know if we want to emigrate or not. We would like to go and have a look and see. We'll go across the Yarden, and if we like it, we'll stay. If we don't, we'll come back. Nothing would have been lost. It's a foolish decision to commit oneself. This is where I'm staying, where you know you're losing. You're losing several mitzvahs. It's true, you're gaining on the cattle side, on the business side, you're gaining, but you don't know whether you're gaining, because maybe Eretz Yisrael is also good. So you assume you're gaining materially, and you know for sure you're losing spiritually. How could they have made such a decision? There's a third medrash. There's a pasuk in Koheles, Lev Chochom liyaminoi, v'lev ksil lismoyle. The heart of a wise person is on his right hand side, and the heart of a foolish person is on his left hand side. There's a sign outside Fortescue Hospital that you should wear one of these silver band, well, these bracelets, and you should say whether you're a wise person or a ksil, so that if they have to remove the heart, they know whether to open on the right hand side or on the left hand side. What does it mean? The Medrash goes through various explanations. And one of them is the following. Lev Chochom liyemune ze Moshe. A Chochom whose heart is on his right hand side, that's Moshe Rabbeinu. Lev Ksil lismoyle, and the heart of a foolish person is on his left hand side. Elu b'nei Reuven v'nei God. This is the children of Reuven and Gad. She'osu eso ika tofel ve'es ha'tofel ika. They suffered from one of the most serious maladies that affects people in our present generation, but it started then already. They made the Ika Tofel and the Tofel Ika. Ika means the substantial aspect, and Tofel means the secondary aspect. They made the primary aspect secondary, and the secondary aspect primary. Because if you look in their wording, they put their money before their children. Shehenayim, for they said, L'moshe, G'deiris tzoyim nivne l'miknenu poi v'orim v'tafenu. No, sir, they said to Moshe, we know we're prepared to go and fight, but first we will build kraals for our cattle and cities for our children. Amalei Moshe, and Moshe hints to them in his reply, Emaklum, that's nothing. That's not the correct way. Elo osu esa ikar ikar tchilo, but make the primary primary. First you build cities for your children. Afterwards, Moshe switches it around in his reply to them. Afterwards you'll build kraals for your cattle. That's what it means. The heart of a wise man is on his right hand side. The heart of a foolish man is on his left hand side. We use our right hands to do important things, and we use our left hands to do secondary things. When you drive a car, at least on this side of the road, you use your right hand to hold the steering wheel and your left hand for the gear. Because changing the gears is not that important. Whatever gear you're in, you can carry on driving. But if you take your hand off the steering wheel, then you're in trouble. You can't carry on driving. It's dangerous to have your hand. So we use our right hand on the steering wheel and the left hand on the gear shift. So Raya, that driving on the left hand side of the road is the right way to drive. And so it is with everything. If one has to do two things simultaneously, we'll always use our right hand to do the primary function and our left hand to do the secondary function. If you're holding a rifle and you want to shoot, you hold the rifle and the finger which is on the trigger is your right hand. You steady the rifle with your left hand. So you'll use the right hand for the Iker and the left hand for the Tofel. But the Negod and the Neiruven switched it around. They became absorbed in the Iker, in the Tofel, and they regarded the Ikr, the primary, as secondary. How could they make such a slip of the tongue? And it was only a slip of the tongue. They didn't mean they would leave their children standing in the fields while they built kraals for the cattle. They had no intention of doing that. Yet, a slip of the tongue is not a slip of the tongue, as Freud taught us and Chazal taught us long before him. Behind every slip of the tongue, there's a subconscious deep meaning. There's a reason why one made the slip of the tongue. And Moshe picks it up immediately and recognizes this is the problem with these people. You showed favor to your cattle over your families. There will not be blessing on your cattle. Nehemiah, as it says in Mishle, Nachalo mevuheles barishono v'achariso loisavoyroch. And here we have the essence of the whole parsha. An inheritance which is based in panic at the initial stages will not ultimately be blessed. It's a pasuk in Mishle. That's the pasuk which the Chazal, which the Medrash, attributes to the Bnei Gad and the Bnei Reuven. For a person to say we will build kraals for our cattle and then cities for our children, nobody would say such a thing. What causes a person to say such a thing, say Chazal? Beholo. They were in a state of panic, they were confused. Once we know that they were in a state of confusion, we can understand why they made the mistake of not going into Eretz Yisrael first. Going into Eretz Yisrael first, that would have been the obvious thing, the rational thing to have done. Let's go into Eretz Yisrael. We know what's on this side. Let's see what's on that side, and then we'll choose. Now, in their panic, they wanted to stay there. Firstly, what causes panic? We had a shiur on it a while back. What causes panic is fear. Nothing else causes panic. And that's where Moshe Rabbeinu picked up that they didn't even want to fight the battle. They said nothing about not wanting to fight the battle. How did Moshe Rabbeinu know that the Akedah proves he was right? They didn't want to fight the battle initially. Where does Moshe Rabbeinu see in their words that they're saying we won't go over and fight? In fact, so distant is it in the meaning of their words that the Sikuna learned it altogether differently. Is it possible that you think that your brethren are willing to conquer the land on their own? While you sit here in peace and tranquility after they helped you conquer this land, and those areas which are already conquered, clearly that can't be what you're contemplating. You know that's an impossibility. And therefore the Sipuna learns your motivation must be to make the other people scared. That's all. It's just for negative reasons. You can't be serious. So in their words, there's no havamina really that they don't want to go and fight. So the Sipuna, that can't be what you mean. But the way we've learned, that is what they meant. The way the Akedah learns, that's exactly what they meant. They didn't want to go and fight. Where does Moshe see that in their words? Moshe sees Beholo. Moshe sees panic, he sees fear. When you see panic and fear, you're not going to go and fight wars. When you're scared, you don't fight wars. When you're busy planning to run from the country and to grab whatever you can on the way, you don't sign up for the army before. That's the last thing that comes into your mind. They're not planning to fight a battle if that's the kind of panic in which they are. In the panic, he saw their fear and he was afraid. Furthermore, Moshe doesn't criticize them about, not openly, about their love of their money and the fact they don't want to go into Eretz Yisrael, for which they're later punished. Moshe doesn't criticize them for that. That's a decision which every individual is entitled to make for himself. The only thing that Moshe criticizes him for is undermining the fabric of Klal Yisrael, spreading panic. That you dare not do. You want to live in Chutz Laaretz, live in Chutz Laaretz. You want to stay here, do what you want. He doesn't even suggest to them, go over the border first and have a look. That's your own decision, do what you want. But what right have you got to spread panic among the rest of Klal Yisrael? That not. And that's the tirade. That's what the Meraglim did, and that's what they were punished for. Those who spread the panic were punished, and those who panicked were punished. The whole generation was punished. The Ribbono Shel Olam was not prepared to lead into Eretz Yisrael a nation of panic. So those who caused the panic, also the Ribbono Shel Olam came down so severely, and Moshe says, are you trying to do the same? Are you trying once again to spread panic among Klal Yisrael before we get into Eretz Yisrael? That one isn't allowed to do. This concept of behola, of panic, is something which affects us every day of our lives. And it causes confusion, which is simply a loss of perspective. This is confused when he doesn't know what is the Iker and what is the Tofer. He doesn't know what is primary and what is secondary. That is the symptom of panic. When he starts treating secondary things as primary and primary things as secondary, then we know he's in a state of panic. And of course that depends on the levels at which one is holding. You'll have a person, for example, who says he's looking for a house to live in. So you'll say, what's important to me is that I have a swimming pool. So I must look for a house with a swimming pool. Now that I found a house with a swimming pool, and it must cost less than 100,000 rand. So he goes to an estate agent and he says, find me a house with a swimming pool that costs less than 100,000 rand. And the estate agent finds him one way out somewhere, and he buys it, and he says, now where's the nearest shul? The nearest shul says 12 kilometers away from here. And where's the nearest Jew? He's 15 kilometers away from here. What's the Iker, what's the Tofel? That's where we judge where a person's holding. We judge his value systems. What are you prepared to sacrifice in order to gain? What do you regard as primary? What do you regard as secondary? That's where we see who the person really is. Everything requires a sacrifice. There is no benefit without a price. The world, we've often talked about how the different systems within the Olam all operate along the same basic formula. What applies in economics applies in science, and what applies in science applies in Ruchnius. It's all the same systems. And the system that everything has a price, that nothing is for nothing, is the same principle as E equals MC squared. You can only change from one to the other, Maile and Moirid. You can raise one and lower the other, but you can't make new money. And you can't create wealth. There's no such thing really as creating wealth. At the end of the day, it's there. There's a certain amount that each individual is capable of making, of contributing. And that's what it is. It's a matter then of passing it around. And if you're going to want certain things, you're going to have to pay. You're going to have to lose on this side in order to gain on the other side. And confusion is typified by a completely unbalanced sense of perspective. What I'm prepared to pay for what? If a person comes in panting and he says, please, I want to buy a piece of paper from you. And you say, sure, how much do you want to pay? He says, anything, 100 grand, 200 grand, whatever you want for the piece of paper. The man's in a panic. You say, 1 minute, you need a tranquilizer, not a piece of paper. Sit down, relax, there's something bothering you. It's a symptom of panic. And so it is, each person in their own levels and in their own routines, one can set one's lifestyle up, and then one's routines up, and then go and find out where one can find shiurim during one's free time. That's one way of doing it. The other way of doing that is find one's shiurim and build one's routines around those times. That's the pshat. That's what is meant by asei tiros chokev. Make your Torah the fixed times of your day. That's what's going to decide how you operate, when you operate, obviously within certain ramifications. But that's the routine that has to be adopted. And when we don't do that, that's also a sign of confusion. What is really important at the end of the day? What are we living for? You'll find the person who can't afford to pay for Jewish education for his child, so he sends his child to a government school. Can't afford to pay for Jewish education, but a billiards table he's got to be able to buy, and two motor cars he's got to have, and a swimming pool and a squash court he's got to have. Where's the sense of values? That's confusion. Now, confusion is sometimes caused by lack of knowledge. People have a distorted sense of values. And sometimes you can have a very fine person who has a very fine sense of values, but he's in a state of panic, he's in a state of shock. And in a state of shock, he doesn't know what's what. And he loses that sense of balance, and temporarily, his system of values goes for a loop. One of the areas that one finds at the moment among South Africans, of course, is in the area of immigration. And as I've said many times before, I'm not willing or able to discuss publicly whether one should contemplate immigration or one shouldn't, because those are such personal decisions, and it varies so much in each individual's case. There's so many different factors that have to be weighed up that no two people can be viewed in the same light. But what has to be avoided at all costs is panic. And when you see how people are integrating, then you see the behola, you see the shock and the panic. You say to the person, where are you going? So he's going to some town in America. What shul do you belong to? He says, well, they don't call shuls there, they call them temples. Same thing, it's a temple. You say, no, it's not the same thing. Is it a conservative temple? He says, no, actually there isn't a conservative temple in that particular town, there's only a reform temple. So he goes to the reform temple. And you say, one second, in South Africa, did you run away because you were afraid for your life? No, he says, I just don't feel there was a future for my children. So you start asking yourself, where's the sense of values? No future for your children in South Africa? So you go to a town in America where there's guaranteed no future? Where they can't come out Jewish? So you've taken them from a place where you think that maybe there's a chance they'll lose their Olam Hazeh. Somebody might shoot them down in the street and they'll lose their Olam Hazeh. So you take them away from there, from where they might lose this world, small chance, one in a million, and you take them to a place where their Olam Hazeh, they definitely lose. And you say, where's the sense of values? And it's a sensible person. It's panic. Plain and simple panic. Gets into a state of shock and takes decisions which are totally irrational. You find that the place that people consider are sometimes wrong. The timing that people consider are sometimes wrong. The way they handle their business interests are sometimes wrong. Sometimes you find a person who's just building up, just at the point of having built up a business. And now he's going to emigrate. Good, he wants to emigrate. You keep your business here. You spend part of the year here. You continue. This is what you're going to live with. He's going to Eretz Yisrael, he's going to a kibbutz, but you don't need money, and he's enthused with this wonderful idea, and he sells his business, which he's built up over years, for nothing. He goes over like a pauper, and he is in the seventh heaven, until he has to marry off his children, and he's got no assets. Nothing. And you say, my goodness, but you were just building up something in South Africa. What did you do with that? I came to a kibbutz, and I sold myself as a slave. You know, when a slave goes free, if one sells oneself as a slave and one has a Jewish master, one can go out with a bit of money. But if you sell yourself as a slave to a communist, you go out with nothing. Nothing. I didn't realize when I came I was becoming a communist. But Eretz Israel, Eretz HaKodesh, and I went to a religious kibbutz school. He doesn't realize that just as today there are religious prostitutes, and there are religious all sorts of things, and religious ganovim, and religious roitzchim, religious murderers, and religious robbers, and religious thieves. So there are religious communists who learn Torah and practice mitzvahs and believe in communism. That he doesn't understand. I saw I was going to a from place. How bad can it be? And so he takes everything he's got, and he loses his self-dignity. And he finds himself in a situation where he can't marry off his children. He has to leave the kibbutz with nothing, and he has to become a beshulich. He has to go around back to South Africa and ask for some money to help. That's what he's got to do. He says, but Rabbi Nishon, what did you do? He's panicked. I was scared. What were you scared of? Fear. Fear is a real emotion. One has to handle it. There's only one way not to handle fear, and that's to get into a panic. Because in a panic, one will not take the right decision. It's not that the chances of taking the right decision in panic are virtually nil, it can't be. I had a woman who came into my office on Friday. She is a multi-millionaireess, not a millionaireess. Her husband is also a multi-millionaire, and it's not the same million I'm referring to. And they were multi-millionaires before the rands went down, and they're multi-millionaires in dollars and in rands, both in this country and overseas. And she comes in a panic. She's got a very beautiful diamond ring which she showed me. She needs to get it out of the country. She's worried about the future. I don't know why she came to me. But after I composed myself a little bit and got over my feelings of deep sympathy for her, I asked her as a matter of interest, how much are you willing to pay to get that diamond out of South Africa? She said, anything, name your price. I said to her exactly then, that's when I was preparing the shiur. I said, lady, you don't need your diamond out of the country. You need a cup of coffee. And you need to relax and tell me what's bothering you. Why are you in such a state of panic? What happened today? What brought you in here? There's no way one can make the right decision when one's panicking. It can't be. One loses sense of values. One loses perspective totally. One takes decisions to go to places which might be wonderful places, but one hasn't seen them yet. There are families who've made decisions to go and live in places, particularly in Eretz Israel, which they haven't seen, or which their wives haven't seen. They come to Eretz Israel, and the wife can't adjust. And there's a life of misery, where either they've got to move from that place, or they've got to come back from Eretz Israel, having lost money on both sides, or there's a divorce, or an unhappy marriage. Why didn't you take your wife over first and have a look, spend a few months there? It's costing you so much to emigrate. So spend 2-3 months in Eretz Israel there. Sit and live, feel what it's like in the place you want to live before you make such a dramatic decision. There's no time to spend 3 months there. South Africa's on a time bomb, you know. It's all the panic and how dangerous it is. One's prepared to sacrifice shalom bayis because of the panic, because of the fear. Where is one's sense of value? The worst thing of all is that somehow when one's life is being threatened, one doesn't panic that much. It's quite amazing. Sure, you've all had the experience of moments when you feel suddenly physically threatened. You think there's somebody in the house, you think you're being followed. How very clearly your mind works. The adrenaline starts operating and you start thinking very quickly and very often very wisely, intuitively. Sometimes you're driving a motor car and you get into a skid or something happens and you're going quickly and the other one's going quickly and you react and you say to yourself afterwards, how did I react so cleverly? How did I even think of doing what I did? There is within each of us and within the animals as well, that's nothing particularly human, an intuitive ability to protect ourselves. And we know how to do it. Usually when our lives are threatened, we don't panic. The times we panic is when our money is threatened. That's when we do stupid things. That's when we do foolish things. If you look how often the murders that one reads about in the newspaper have been over money matters and over foolish handling of situations where one's money has become threatened. That's where one panics and acts ridiculously. Not so much when one's life is being threatened. And very few of the people who are panicking in our situation are panicking because they believe their life is threatened. They're worried about their assets, their money, and what will happen if in the future we have to go, and one day we might have to go with nothing, like paupers. That's what we're worried about. Not that I might get shot at, that's not what worries me. There are other places in the world which are more dangerous, and I'm prepared to go there, because I believe there's a future there. Good, so what you're worried about is the future. What future? Not the future of your life you're worried about, not the future educationally, Torah. You've got what you want. You've got a community, you've got schools, you've got Tehila, you've got Bnei Torah, everything's fine, you're earning a living. Just that you worry that there's going to become a time where you might lose what you've got economically, and that causes the panic.
The panic is triggered off. Moshe picks up in their words by too much emphasis on the money. That's what they're worried about. First we'll make the kraals, then we'll build the cities. Not that that's what they would have done, but that's what they said. And that indicates the source of the panic. And the Torah hints at that by placing the umikne rav yolivnei ruven v'livnei god at the beginning of the sentence. The important part of the sentence is not bnei ruven and bnei god, it's their money. Bnei ruven and bnei god are the heftzes, they are the objects. The subject is the money, the money is the controlling factor. And they are just little pawns being manipulated by their assets. Their entire panic and the wrong decisions were set off by that panic. And when one panics, how easy and willing one is to accept comfort and to accept whatever is offered, and how crooked one can get. On the way to shul, my brother and I were talking about a friend of mine that I haven't seen for many years, and I said, you know, what is he doing in Eretz Yisrael? And there was a moment of hesitation. My brother was afraid to tell me. He said, well, he's working on a kibbutz. So, very nice. What does he do? This is, by the way, a highly qualified, super qualified engineer. With a very fine mind, a very fine person. He says he's cleaning toilets, and he loves it. they persuaded him that that's a major contribution to Eretz Yisrael. A person trained as a sophisticated engineer. Where's the self-respect? And he believes it. He feels happy. He feels satisfied. What can be done with the human mind? How it can be twisted and distorted to persuade an individual that he's happy in a situation where his dignity and pride and self-essence has been robbed of him? And to be told that that's good? I'm not talking about somebody, by the way, who's cleaning the toilets because he can't find anything else to do and he wants time to sit and learn Torah and to do mitzvahs. We're not talking about that kind of person. If that was the case, good, fine. I'm not talking about such a person. There's an ideology in it. It's the ideology. That's the atmosphere which panic creates. When people are in a state of panic, you can persuade them that anything is heaven. That's when you can take people on whatever ride you want. You can make millions of them by selling them whatever you want at whatever price you want, as long as you promise them that it's going to ease their panic. That's all you have to do. They'll pay anything for it. They'll do. There's just no sense of perspective at all. They don't have a sense of value. They don't have a sense of proportion. And whatever you offer him and you tell him, this is good for you. You know how it is when sometimes a person feels down and out. A person never is very ill. He comes to his doctor. He'll take whatever the doctor gives him. When a person feels depressed and goes to the psychologist, he'll take whatever the psychologist gives him. All he needs to be told is by a professional person, this will get you right. That's all he is. Are you sure, doctor? Yes, I'm sure. That's all he needs to be told. He's willing to pay for it. What goes on? If you look at the scandal that's going on now with these skin creams, that they've discovered, a particular skin cream that's all a lot of nonsense. It's just ordinary oil. There's nothing more than ordinary oil would do. Now they're beginning to discover that all the skin creams are the same. It costs tens of rand for little boxes. Why are people willing to do it? You tell a lady, this will remove your wrinkles. She doesn't ask the price. This will remove the wrinkles. What's more important than that? Who cares what the price is? When a person is in a state of panic, they don't ask the price. When a person is in a state of panic, he's willing to pay anything, he's willing to do anything. That's what has to be avoided. He'll clean the toilets with a smile on his face. That imbecilic smile that, yeah, my wrinkles are going. I found a tablet which will keep me young. This imbecilic smile on the individual's face. Where does it come from? A complete loss of proportion, loss of sense of values. It says, Moshe Rabbeinu, you've lost your sense of values, that's your own business. You haven't come to me for counseling. You've come to me to ask whether you can stay here and not go there to Israel. That not. No scary babies and no jelly babies. You go and you fight. That's my business, says Moshe Rabbeinu, is to look after the fabric of Klal Yisrael, and you're not going to destroy what we're building up. You want to stay there? Stay there. Do what you want. You want to panic? Panic. But that's not going to spread to Klal Yisrael. And they have to go back and come to the conclusion that they're willing to fight. And afterwards they committed to their decision to stay in what halachically is just, in the smallest sense, Chutz La'aretz. If that decision was wrong, only because there were two or three mitzvahs that could be kept further in Eretz Yisrael, which couldn't be kept over there. The decision was wrong because they could have lived as successfully within Eretz Yisrael. One only makes a spiritual sacrifice if there is no alternative. But Chas v'Sholom to make a spiritual sacrifice if there are alternatives. And what I'm saying is, although immigration is what people find as a favorite topic at the moment, it doesn't apply only to that. It applies to everything we do throughout our days. That knowledge and understanding that there are certain things that one gives up only if there is no choice. As I'll say, property, one doesn't sell property unless one really has no choice. One doesn't speculate on property. One doesn't buy and sell. You keep property. Property is meant to be kept. It only goes up. If you're desperate, you sell. Ruchnius, lahavdil, is the property among assets. That's something you never give up. You only collect, you only add. You never give it up. You never trade it in. Unless you're desperate, you have to save your life. And if the only way to save one's life is to give up ruchnius, and the Chai Bohem, you've got to do so. For nearly all of the Torah, you've got to, rather, in order to save your life, you are permitted to give up the Ruchnius, because if you're living, you might get it back again. Once you're dead, it's finished. But only under those circumstances. And therefore, just to retain that sense of value and that sense of perspective. Not to make decisions which are going to bind one number one, without having done one's homework, and number two, not to take decisions which can in any way compromise the spiritual quality of one's life, which includes the education of one's children, the education of oneself, the quality of one's family life, the time that one is going to have available for Torah or mitzvahs. All these things, don't consider for a moment trading in, unless you have to. That doesn't mean that there might be many opportunities for some to be able to keep that and do better. Find a person who can change his job or change his place of living, and he's able to retain everything he has spiritually or even improve, and earn a little bit more money, or feel a little bit more secure, or do a little bit better. There is no shyness. Of course one is permitted and one is encouraged to make a move which is one of improvement. One needs to think very carefully and not to allow in one's state of panic oneself to be duped and to have oneself marketed, whatever happens to look glossy and whatever on the surface appears to solve one's problems. There's only one who can solve one's problems, and that, with Siyata Dishmaya, is one's own self.